Welcome everybody, I'm Bande Sujato, and we are here in Harris Park on the land of the Burramadigal people of the Darug Nation. And with respects to the elders past, present and emerging, we are very grateful to be able to be here and to practice our path, our religion, and to do what the Buddha said, which is, what did the Buddha say to do? What did the Buddha say? I mean, he said a lot of things, okay? Do what's wholesome, don't do what's unwholesome, and meditate to clarify your mind. That's the Buddha's path. Sometimes we make things very complicated. When I say we, I mean I. But, but in its essence, the Buddha's path is very simple. Do what's good, don't do what's bad, and purify your mind. And for today, we're going to do some chanting, some meditation, and a bit of a Dhamma talk, and maybe some questions. So this will be the last talk of the Rains Retreat. I believe the Rains Retreat's finishing tomorrow, is that right? Is that right there? It's Sunday, is it? The formal end of the Rains. Tomorrow's the last day of the...
Yeah,
Sunday's for Warana. Okay. It's probably different, might be different in Sri Lankan and Thai system. Yeah, usually we follow the Bodhnyana calendar, which is the Thai system, so sometimes one day different, yeah. All right, so anyway, it's coming to an end. Oh my God. There is an allowance to be able to extend it. So every year we kind of threaten to do that, but we never seem to do it. Anyway, let us begin with the chanting. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang saranang gacchami. Dhammang saranang gacchami. Sanghang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. Iti piso bhagava arahang samma sambuddho vijja charana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarathi. Sattha deva manusanam buddho bhagavati. Svakato bhagavata dhammo sandhitiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko. Pachatang veditabo vinyuhiti.
Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Ujjupatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Nyayapatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Samichipatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Yaridam chattari purisayugani attha purisa puggala esa bhagavato savaka sangho. Ahuneyo pahuneyo dakhineyo anjali karaniyo anuttaram punya ketam lokasati.
So for today's meditation, we're going to do a kind of meditation called Cittanupassana. So Cittanupassana, contemplation of the mind, is part of the third Satipatthana, the third foundation of mindfulness, or the third kind of mindfulness meditation. And it involves a reflective awareness of awareness itself. Now, this meditation is quite a subtle one. Hence, it's not usually what we would teach in a short guided meditation like this. But for today, we'll have a go and we'll see what it's like. Now, the nature of the mind. The Buddha said mano or citta or vijnana, consciousness. Nature of this mind, this awareness, is subtle and fleeting. And the Buddha actually said that you're better off being attached to your body than you are to your mind, because at least your body hangs around for a few years before it's inevitable decay and disintegration, whereas your mind is just changing all the time. And in meditation, we have all experienced how difficult and how almost ghost-like the contents of our mind are. The thoughts, the fleeting images, the shifting fields of almost colours or energies, just all those different things that are happening in your mind. And all of those things are hazy, and we glimpse them like looking at a reflection of a mist. In the reflection of a mist in a mirror. And if those things are hazy and difficult to see, what of the mind itself that is aware of those things? How much more difficult is that to see? How much more subtle is it to see awareness itself? So subtle, in fact, that there is a genuine philosophical problem about whether we are actually ever able to really directly see the mind, or if we can only ever see glimpses and recollections and mirror and reflections of it. But for now, our main purpose in the meditation will be to simply get some kind of idea of what it is like to focus on subjectivity, to focus on awareness, to know the knowing. And it is to me interesting that in Western philosophy, Western mathematics for thousands of years, and as subtle and powerful Western mathematics became, they never noticed the number zero. And it was Indians who noticed the number zero, drawing no doubt on Buddhist philosophy, which said that emptiness is important. And similarly, Western philosophy, and I think to a large extent to this present day, has never really noticed this knowing. It's never really noticed awareness. And it concerned itself with thoughts and ideas and concepts, the things that the mind does. Whereas in India, there was this fascination with the awareness of all of these things. Something so fundamental, so elusive. So when the Buddha talked about cittanupassana, about observing the mind, or when he talked about citta bhavana, developing the mind, this is what he was talking about. He was talking about being able to know this awareness and to hold that awareness in such a way as to lead to its clarity, its radiance, its beauty, its shining, so that the mind will know better. That's it. That's the essence of Buddhist meditation, to know better. So let's begin the meditation as usual. Start by establishing your posture. With your back straight, and bring awareness inside your body. And now as we sit here, I want you to bring your focus to the center of knowing. To that which sits in the middle and observes everything that's going on around. Not the things you see, not the things you hear, not the things you smell, or taste, or touch, and not the things that you think, not the things that you remember, not the things that you imagine, not the things that you perceive. Nothing that you know, but only the knowing itself. Your knowing has certain attributes or qualities that you can use to understand it better. Ask yourself, is your knowing dark or bright? Is your knowing small or big? When you think you know what that awareness is, you probably don't. Usually, when we're doing this meditation, what we find is that we grasp onto certain aspects of what the mind does, certain of the phenomena or activities that the mind is doing, and we think this is awareness. But awareness is so subtle. It's underneath those things, it's inside them. At every step in this meditation, we are we take side steps. We're distracted. Mind is so shy, hides away, unknown. hidden in the midst of all things, making everything that's known possible, but itself not wanting to be known. So don't be too quick. Don't be too confident. Keep looking. Keep searching. Okay, so now coming near to the end of the meditation. Bring your awareness back out into your senses, the touches, the sound. And reflect back over the course of the meditation. Ask yourself, how did that go? Were you able to experience that awareness, that citta, that mind? What was that like? What kind of qualities or properties did it have? Was it smooth and peaceful? Was it like sandy and rough? Was it brittle or soft? And how does your mind feel like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy, may all beings be well, may all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Excellent. All right, let's have a break. See you back here in a few minutes. From Wat Chedi Luang in Chiang Mai. I thought, well, since we're talking about Chiang Mai, we should get some bells from there. What a world we live in. All right. Okay, so how's everyone going? We're all good? Yes? Ready to embark on another sutta adventure? So I've sort of inadvertently stumbled upon this thing of doing sutta classes for the Rains Retreat. And we've done a bunch of very deep suttas from the Madhyama Nikaya, like some Madhupindika Sutta, and we did like the Alagadupama Sutta, some pretty intense and quite challenging suttas. So I thought, for a complete change of pace today, we might do another really difficult and long sutta. The Maha Tanha Sankhaya Sutta. Last week we did the Chula Tanha Sankhaya Sutta, the shorter discourse on the ending of craving, and now we're doing the longer discourse on the ending of craving. Okay, longer discourse means even more fun discourse on the ending of craving. Okay, so this is quite a bit of a long sutta and a bit of a difficult one, so we'll see how far we get with the discussion. Not sure if we'll be able to have time to look really at all of it and give it a due, but at least we'll be able to check some things out. Yes. Maha Tanha Sankhaya Sutta.
Okay, and what's Sankhaya?
Sankhaya ending. Okay. Ending of craving, yeah. The longer discourse on the ending of craving. So I have heard. One time the Buddha was staying near Sarvati in Jeta's Grove at Pindika's monastery. Now, at that time, a mendicant called Sati, the fisherman's son, had the following harmful misconception. Okay? It's one of the monks. As I understand the Buddha's teachings, it is this very same consciousness that roams and transmigrates, not another. Several mendicants heard about this. They went up to Sati and said, "Is it really true, Reverend Sati, that you had such a harmful misconception? As I understand the Buddha's teachings, it is this very same consciousness that roams and transmigrates, not another." "Absolutely, Reverend. As I understand the Buddha's teachings, it is this very same consciousness that roams and transmigrates, not another." Then, wishing to dissuade Sati from his view, the mendicants pursued, pressed, and grilled him. "Don't say that, Sati. Don't misrepresent the Buddha, for misrepresentation of the Buddha is not good, and the Buddha would not say that. In many ways, the Buddha has said that consciousness is dependently originated, since without a cause, consciousness does not come to be." But even though the mendicants pressed him in this way, Sati obstinately stuck to his misconception and insisted on stating it. When they weren't able to dissuade Sati from his view, the mendicants went to the Buddha, bowed, and sat down to one side. And they told him what happened. The Buddha addressed one of the monks. "Please, monk, in my name, tell the mendicant Sati that the teacher summons him." "Yes, sir," the monk replied. He went to Sati and said to him, "Reverend Sati, the teacher summons you." Got to be a little bit nervous at that point. "Oh, really? Okay." "Yes, Reverend," Sati replied. He went to the Buddha, bowed, and sat down to one side. The Buddha said to him, "Is it really true that you had this harmful misconception? It is this very same consciousness that roams and transmigrates, not another." "Absolutely, sir. It is this very same consciousness." "Sati, what is that consciousness?" "Sir, he is the speaker, the knower, who experiences the results of good and bad deeds in all the different realms." To which the Buddha responded, "Silly man, who on earth have you ever known me to teach in that way? Haven't I said in many ways that consciousness is dependently originated, since consciousness does not arise without a cause? But still, you misrepresent me by your wrong grasp, harm yourself, and create much wickedness. This will be for your lasting harm and suffering." Then the Buddha said to the mendicants, "What do you think, mendicants? Has this mendicant Sati kindled even a spark of ardor in this teaching and training?" "How could that be, sir?" "No, sir." When this was said, Sati sat silent, dismayed, shoulders drooping, downcast, depressed, with nothing to say. So this is the introduction. Poor old Sati, right? I mean, it seems kind of innocent enough, right? Right, could be worse, exactly. I mean, he's not like, you know, he's just expressing an opinion on the nature of consciousness or whatever. So we have has a hand raiser or something? Sorry. Maybe if you got something to say, you can pop it in the chat, that would be better. Thanks, and we have questions a bit later on. Okay, so let's go back over that introduction and have a look at it in a little bit more detail. So who was Sati, the fisherman's son? Well, we don't really know very much about him. So that's that. So obviously the most important line here is this idea about the very same consciousness that roams and transmigrates. Okay, so let's break this down and see clearly what exactly Sati is saying and what he is not saying. So in that statement that he makes, there are really kind of three main assumptions. The first one is that there is such a thing as samsara, right, which I'm translating as transmigration, right? Samsara. So you, in other words, you get born in one life and then in another life. Okay, so this is this idea of samsara, which the Buddha obviously taught, and which is implicit in what Sati says. Second thing is that this samsara has to do with consciousness, right? Yeah, it's consciousness which undergoes samsara. And third thing is that that consciousness that transmigrates is this very same consciousness, not another. Yeah. Now, the Buddha, in fact, taught the first two of those things. He taught that there is such a thing as samsara, transmigration, rebirth. He taught that consciousness is the principle, like the stream of consciousness is the principle that proceeds through this transmigration, or that transmigrates. But what he objects to is the third one, that it is this very same consciousness and not another. Right? That's the point that he's objecting to. Of course, this idea, very self-evidently, sounds similar to ideas that you find in the Upanishads and in the non-Buddhist teachings at the time. And obviously, Sati was influenced by these. So, as usual, took the time to go back and have a look at the references and the text and find that this has some similarities to a particular chapter of the Brihadaranyaka, the chapter 4.4. Now, this is a very interesting chapter of the Upanishads, which you should go and have a read because it really is fascinating. But one of the ideas about it is that as death approaches, your senses, your vital energies, they withdraw into your heart, into your hridaya, from the top of which the self departs. Okay, so this kind of almost like quasi-organic notion of the process of rebirth. Then that same consciousness proceeds to a new body. Savijnana bhavati, savijnanam eva avakramati. That same eva, that very same one. So this is a similar language to the language that Sati is using. It's that very same consciousness which is proceeding to a new body. There's another kind of interesting detail for Pali students. I won't go into it too much, but for anybody who's been in the Pali student class, have a look at the note that I've given for this passage, and you'll see I talk about the way that the duplicated demonstrative pronouns emphasized with the particle eva are there. So this is what I've translated as that very same consciousness. It's quite a distinctive and highly emphatic construct in the language. And exactly that same construct is used throughout this Brihadaranyaka Upanishad passage. So we've got a very clear that what Sati is saying is not just loosely or sort of generally in the same sphere as what the Upanishads are saying, it's clearly saying exactly the same thing. It is that very same consciousness. Of course, for the Upanishad, that consciousness is the self. And again, this is said quite explicitly in that passage. Sava ayam atma brahma vijnanamayo, which means that this is that self which is Brahma, which is divinity, which is made of consciousness. And the commentator explains that as the transmigrating self, the samsara dhyatma. So it's that consciousness which is Brahma and which is the self. Now, Sati doesn't quite say that. He doesn't say it is this same consciousness which is your Atman and which is the Brahman, right? He doesn't actually bring that bit in. He kind of leaves that bit aside. But there's enough from what he says to show that that's what he's saying anyway. Now, of course, this kind of view is very common in Buddhism today. In fact, I would say that in certain kinds of Buddhism, certain circles of Buddhism, it's the kind of mainstream view that there is this kind of underlying eternal consciousness or something like that that goes from one life to the other. I'm not going to discuss that in detail, and to be honest, I don't really know enough about those kinds of ideas to be able to say, but clearly those kinds of ideas in modern Buddhism are, I don't know, but I kind of think that anybody who's teaching that kind of thing in modern Buddhism would probably get the same treatment that poor old Sati got. And there is a difference between what the Buddha taught and what the Upanishads taught. And you know that, you know, over these classes I've been sort of taking the time and the effort to sort of look into this. And one of the things, you know, I was reflecting about that, like one of the things, why have I done this? Why have so many Buddhist scholars not done this? And why have I done this? And, you know, it's one of these things sometimes you can't really explain rationally. But one of the reasons why I've done it is because I love the teachings of the Upanishads. I find them very beautiful and very inspiring. And I think the idea that there is some kind of divinity who you are, and which is a spark of the divinity of the whole universe. Well, this is a really beautiful idea. I don't know, maybe I was like a Hindu rishi in my past life or something like that. I don't know. You know, but to me, there's something that I can relate to those teachings. I can understand why these are really beautiful and very seductive teachings. I don't believe them, right? But I like them, you know? And so I found it really fascinating to look into this. I think one of the reasons why I've been drawn to sort of try to understand what is going on here with what the Buddha, how the Buddha is relating to these things. Anyway, the Buddha is pretty straightforward here. That's a complete misrepresentation of the Buddha. And, you know, that's one of the things, to me, it's one of the things, like, if you believe that, then great. You know, you've got this whole wonderful, amazing spiritual tradition of Advaita Vedanta in India, which has been there for thousands of years and which has a lot of great teachers and meditation traditions and things. And if that's what you believe, join that tradition and follow it. Great. But it's not what the Buddha taught. So, as you can see, the Buddha does not like being misrepresented. Yeah? If he doesn't mind being disagreed with, right? So if you go up and you disagree with him, he'll have a discussion. But if you say, "Oh, this is what you've said," then he'll get a little bit. I couldn't say annoyed, but I couldn't say he'd get a little bit annoyed. But it kind of feels like he gets a little bit annoyed by that.
It's quite harsh.
It's quite harsh, right? Yeah. So, and it's not like with the other case where there's a similar introduction is with Aritta in the Alagadupama Sutta. Now, in that case, he was basically saying, and this is being a bit reductive, but he was basically saying there's nothing wrong with having sex if you're a monk, okay? So you can see the Buddha was maybe like, it's a little bit more challenging. This is a fairly kind of subtle philosophical point, right? It's not quite as... anyway, so...
But what he was saying is that, look, it's some bad karma for such a long time. It sounds like he was a really weighty, negative thing.
Yes, but remember that it's the misrepresentation which is bad karma. It's not the actual view itself, yeah? So the view itself, you know, that's that you can practice according to that and then get reborn in the formless realms and stay there for tens of thousands of eons of just literally just chilling out in the formless realms, right? That's fine. But it's a misrepresentation which is the problem here, yeah. So, Sati gives this kind of clarification. It is the knower who experiences, he is the speaker or the knower, who experiences the result of good or bad actions in all the different realms. That same phrase is actually found in the Sabhasava Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 2, where it's also expanded to say this self is permanent, everlasting, eternal and imperishable and will last forever and ever. So there being a more explicit statement of the eternal self. And so it seems that, you know, Sati was sort of, he was sort of underlying, had the same view, but sort of refrain from saying anything that would be so directly contradicting the Buddha's teachings. If you go to... I won't go into it here, but if you go to the links on Sutta Central, there's also Upanishadic parallels for that passage as well, which I will leave aside just for now. Okay, moving on. The Buddha then says, oh, and just another quick note here, the Buddha asks a question, has Sati kindled even a spark of ardour in this teaching and training? This is quite a distinctive phrase, which is found only in the Alagadupama Sutta also, which we've discussed earlier, and the Pali is usmi kato. I believe I discussed that in that context. But the basic idea is that usmi is, I think, related to the idea of tapas, which is the kind of, in this case, just means enthusiasm or energy or commitment for the training. Okay, so poor old Sati. Then the Buddha goes on. Knowing this, the Buddha said, silly man, you'll be known by your own harmful misconception. I'll question the mendicants about this. The Buddha's not wrong with that, by the way. Like, basically all we know about Sati is from this sutta. So it's like literally what he's gone down and famous for is getting a dressing down by the Buddha. Do you understand? And the Buddha said to the mendicants, do you understand my teachings as Sati does when he misrepresents me with his wrong grasp, harms himself and creates much wickedness? I mean, it's kind of a loaded question. But anyway, the monk said, no, sir. For in many ways, the Buddha has told us that consciousness is dependently originated, since without a cause, consciousness does not come to be. Good, good mendicants, it's good that you understand this teaching like this. For in many ways I've told you that consciousness is dependently originated, since without a cause, consciousness does not come to be. This is like such an important point. We just need to linger on this a little bit. The Buddha's response to the idea of this eternal, underlying, nibbanic consciousness is precisely dependent origination. It's not something which is just a marginal note in the Buddha's teachings. It's an underlying principle that informs the entirety of literally everything that the Buddha talked about. The consciousness is dependently originated. And we'll go through and see the Buddha's analysis of this. But do you see the point here? How can something be eternal if it's conditioned? It's got to be originated from causes, then it can't be eternal. How can something be an infinite or last forever if the causes upon which it depends are limited and don't last forever? This is this whole kind of nature of empirical existence and empirical reality. You don't see things that are finite create things that are infinite. It can't happen. So the consciousness is always conditioned. When we did the meditation a little bit earlier, we were starting to look into this nature of consciousness. Yeah? And we began to see how slippery it is and how easy it is to take the knower, he is the one who knows, he sits in here, and to take that as being something permanent and all the things that you know as being impermanent. Yeah? So this is why we look at the nature and the quality of that knowing. Yeah? Is it dark? Is it bright? Is it expansive or contracted? Is it smooth and silky, or is it rough and coarse? And we see that this consciousness also is changing all the time. But we also analyze it in terms of the senses, in terms of like the different awareness through the different kinds of senses and so on. Anyway, let's see how the Buddha goes on to talk about this. Consciousness is reckoned according to the very same condition dependent upon which it arises. It's a very subtle point in the text here. The Buddha is using the same linguistic construct that Sati uses when he talked about the very same consciousness. Tadevida, right? And so this is using duplicated pronouns in the same emphatic sense. So the same emphasis that Sati said, this consciousness is the very same one that precedes, the Buddha is now using the same degree of emphasis to say it's reckoned according to the very same condition. Right? It's absolutely conditioned. He's ramming this home point. Consciousness that arises dependent on the eye and sights is eye consciousness. Consciousness that arises dependent on the ear and sounds is reckoned as ear consciousness. Consciousness that arises dependent on the nose and smells is reckoned as nose consciousness. Consciousness that arises dependent on the tongue and taste is reckoned as tongue consciousness. Consciousness that arises dependent on the body and touches is reckoned as body consciousness. Consciousness that arises dependent on the mind and ideas is reckoned as mind consciousness. It's like fire, which is reckoned according to the very same condition dependent upon which it burns. A fire that burns dependent on logs is reckoned as a log fire. A fire that burns dependent on twigs is reckoned as a twig fire. A fire that burns dependent on grass is reckoned as a grass fire. A fire that burns dependent on cow dung is reckoned as a cow dung fire. A fire that burns dependent on husks is reckoned as a husk fire. A fire that burns dependent on rubbish is reckoned as a rubbish fire. So again, the Buddha coming back and re-emphasizing these same point again and again. Notice how in the use of the metaphors, the Buddha is using both the direct meaning of the metaphor, right, that it's dependent on the fire, right, but also the connotations of the metaphor. Yeah, that consciousness is something that burns. Yeah. Again, this is in direct contradiction with the Upanishads, which talk about honey. The eye is the honey for sights. The sights are honey for the eyes. The eyes and the mind that rises is the honey for all of these things. And that self which lives inside you is the honey for all of this divinity. It's nice, right? It's an attractive thing. This is fundamental idea that the world is made of divinity, and so all of these things are partaking in this same essence of divinity, which is like honey. So it's called the Madhu Vija in the Upanishads, and so the Buddha is quite turning this upside down. All of these things are like fire, and so fire is something which is useful, right? Can be nice. I see that up in Canberra that Alison and Hugo have a fire burning in their room there. And so that's nice and warming in the right place if you've got it under control. But at the same time, very I'm not sure if that's it looks like a real fire, right? Yeah, it looks like a real one. Anyway, so in the right way, but it also will burn and it will scorch and it will harm you. But fire is also a direct opposite for the whole simile of Nibbana, right? So Nibbana is the extinguishment of the flame. So just as the fire that arises here, Nibbana is the cooling of the flame. Of course, if the Buddha was teaching somewhere else other than in India where it's hot, if he was teaching in Canberra where it's cold, or in Sweden or somewhere, then he'd probably come up with a different simile to describe these things, right? But that's... what it's about. Okay, moving on. So, mendicants, do you see that this has come to be? So the this in this statement means the dependently originated consciousness. Do you see that this has come to be? Do you see that it originated with that as fuel? Do you see that when the fuel ceases, what has come to be is liable to cease? Does doubt arise when you're uncertain whether or not this has come to be? Yes. Does doubt arise when you're uncertain whether or not this has originated with that as fuel? Yes, sir. Does doubt arise when you're uncertain whether or not when that fuel ceases, what has come to be is liable to cease? Yes, sir. Is doubt given up in someone who truly sees with right understanding that this has come to be? Yes, sir. So this giving up of doubt is the stream enterer who has seen dependent origination for themselves. Is doubt given up in someone who truly sees with right understanding that this has originated with that as fuel, i.e. that the consciousness, that specific consciousness, has originated with that as fuel? Notice that the Buddha always teaches specific conditionality. This arises with that as fuel, just as the different kinds of fire have different kinds of fuel. Is doubt given up in someone who truly sees with right understanding that when that fuel ceases, what has come to be is liable to cease? Yes, sir. Are you free of doubt as to whether this has come to be? Yes, sir. Are you free of doubt as to whether this has originated with that as fuel, as to when the fuel ceases? Have you seen clearly, and the Buddha repeats all the questions, have you seen clearly that this has come to be? Have you seen clearly that this has originated with that as fuel? Have you truly seen with right understanding that when that fuel ceases, what has come to be is liable to cease? Yes, sir. So the mendicants there that the Buddha is asking, interrogating, are asserting that they understand and they see with their own understanding dependent origination. The Buddha then says, pure and bright as this view is, if you cherish it, fancy it, treasure it, and treat it as your own, would you be understanding my simile of the teaching as a raft for crossing over, not for holding on? No, sir. Pure and bright as this view is, mendicants, if you don't cherish it, fancy it, treasure it, and treat it as your own, would you be understanding my simile of the teaching as a raft for crossing over, not for holding on? Yes, sir. So, of course, this is an allusion back to the Alagadupama Sutta, Majjhima 22. And something that we discussed in the context of that sutta, but of course this is interesting from a textual point of view. So the simile of the raft is taught in Majjhima 22, but in other suttas, like here, the Buddha is alluding to it. So this is a kind of internal reference that shows that people are already familiar with that other sutta, and the Buddha didn't have to explain it, he just had to allude to it. So sati, if you remember, had his own harmful misconception, right? But it didn't just say have a harmful misconception. So don't misunderstand his whole kind of thing. This wasn't just like a whim. It wasn't a speculation. It wasn't just a thought. Oh, I wonder if it's that same consciousness. It wasn't an idea or a thought that he had. It was a view that he had. And a view has some stickiness to it. Yeah? It stays there. And when they tried to dissuade him, he was obstinate and stubborn. Right? So that's an important difference. Right? The Buddha's not saying that you shouldn't question these things. He's not saying that you shouldn't think these things even. Right? But there's a difference between thinking, oh, maybe this is true, or even believing it. Right? But to obstinately insist that this is what the Buddha taught, despite all evidence to the contrary, that is really the trap that Sati went into. And of course, that's pointing to something other than simply somebody who was, I don't know, maybe interested in some philosophical inquiry, or maybe who didn't quite understand some teachings of the Buddha, or something like that. There's something underlying it. There's an attachment to this wrong view that he had. It wasn't just a sort of an idea or a thought that he had. We all know kind of what that difference is, right? I mean, people have views about all kinds of weird things, you know, about like, you know, what's the best way to make coffee, or what kind of colours are in style this year. I think it's brown, is that right? I think it's brown, as far as I can tell. And people have all these kind of views and opinions about all these kind of crazy things, right? And like in a way, that can be fine, right? Maybe you're chatting with your friends and you're like, oh, you know, the last whatever album by that band was, you know, that was better than the previous one. And you're like, oh, I didn't think it was as good. And then you can have a conversation about that. So to have those views, it's fine, you know. But then if you're obstinately sticking to them and getting into an argument, this is where it becomes a problem. So this is why the Buddha at the end of this is not just checking whether they have the right view, but whether they're being attached to that right view, pure and bright as it is. Okay, moving along. Now, four fuels or foods or nutriments, ahara. Who knows what the four fuels are? Anyone online got those for us? No. Okay, manos, mental intention is one, yes. You said food. Yes, food is one of them. Sense impressions. Yes. Yes. And four? We had that one, volition from Deepika. Number four. we had sense impressions. It's pretty similar, right? That's what I was taking as contact, but yes. And the number four is solid food, coarse or fine, contact, mental intention, and number four?
Consciousness.
Thank you so very much. Consciousness, right? So these are conditions that sustain reality or sustain life. Right? So these are some of the things that keep life going. And the sort of purpose of this teaching is to show that life, well, doesn't depend on bread alone, right? We think of the things that sustain life as food, as being solid food, which is part of it, but also we need contact, right? Think about, for example, what would happen if a baby is born and was brought up without any external stimulus, like in a place of darkness, without any sounds and so on. There's no contact, wouldn't be able to grow and develop. Yeah? Similarly, mental intention, right, is also very important. Again, think about that in terms of development, that if we are growing up and we can't learn to actually do things for ourselves, yeah, you can't do that. You have to know, how do I get up? How do I go here? How do I get a glass of water? And so we have to develop our own mental intention and consciousness, again, the awareness of all of these things. So consciousness is itself conditioned, but also is a condition, one of the things that makes life possible. Now, there's another trick to this, a kind of linguistic trick, which is that ahara is basically the same, almost identically the same word as upadana, which we translate as grasping. Upadana, both ahara means like intake, from the word hara meaning take, upadana meaning like uptake. And so actually upadana and ahara have the same meaning, and they both have those two kind of senses, that they both mean a kind of fuel, like they can be used like as a fuel for fire or something like that, as well as they can both be used in the sense of grasping and attachment. Right? So actually ahara and upadana, they're used in slightly different ways, but they are almost the same meaning. And that is shown in this sutra itself, because it says what's the cause of ahara, and the cause of ahara is craving. Normally in dependent origination, craving is the cause of craving is the cause of? You'll know this at the end. Sorry, go on. Grasping, upadana. Tanha pachaya upadana. So it goes craving to grasping. But here, ahara is in the same place as upadana. That is, fuel is in the same place as grasping. Basically the same meaning. Slightly different perspective of it. What's the source of craving? Feeling. What's the source of feeling? Contact. What's the source of contact? The sixth sense feels. Pay attention. I'm going to grill you about this afterwards. What's the source of the sixth sense feels? Name and form. What's the source of name and form? Consciousness. What's the source of consciousness? Choices. What's the source of choices? Ignorance. So far we've had most of dependent origination, but we started with ahara. So now we're going to be going with the full nature of dependent origination from the beginning. So, ignorance is a condition for choices. Choices are a condition for
consciousness.
Consciousness is a condition for
feelings.
Consciousness is a condition for
human form.
Sorry? Consciousness is a condition for name and form. Name and form are conditions for six senses. Six sense fields are conditions for contact. Contact is a condition for feeling. Feeling is a condition for
craving.
Craving is a condition for grasping. Grasping is a condition for bhava, yeah? Continued ongoing existence. Bhava is a condition for rebirth, yeah, jati. Jati. Rebirth is a condition for all of this stuff, right? Oh, bad backs and having to come and teach a bunch of people. Oh, bloody hell, all of these kinds of things. Oh, my goodness, You know, it's like aging. It's like one of these things, inevitable. The best description of aging was that you wake up one morning and you've got a bad back and inexplicably strong opinions about architecture. Okay, moving along. Okay. Rebirth, that's how this whole mass of suffering originated. Okay, so I'm just going to give a quick analysis of each of these links. So ignorance. Ignorance is ignorance of what? Four Noble Truths. Ignorance is ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. Okay? When you don't know the Four Noble Truths, what happens? Yes, more specifically?
You make karma.
You make karma, right? Thank you, which is a sankhara, which is choices or chetana, right? So when you don't know that the world is just suffering, then you go and think, oh, I want this, and you start making karma, which is both choices, both good and bad, which are the choices or sankhara are like creative forces or energies in the mind that sustain the ongoing stream of sense consciousness from one life to the next, okay? So think of sankhara as being like an energy. It's literally what the word sankhara means. When you make these choices, especially choices that have moral potency, not just any old choices, okay, but choices that matter, choices that mean something, choices to do good or to do bad, those choices, they create an energy in your mind. And that energy is what fuels the ongoing process of samsara. Okay, consciousness is conditioned for name and form. Of course, name and form being defined in the suttas, as of course everybody would know, nama is defined as?
Name.
No, that's just the translation of it. What is it? Nama is, of course... Started out strong, faded in the closing moments there. Feeling, perception, intention, contact, and manasikara, or attention or application of mind. Okay, so these are the essence of name. So name or nama, basically the way to think about that from a psychological point of view is that nama is the things that the mind does. Right, it's all of the stuff, or it's all of the things that you know in your mind. When you sit there, when we're sitting there early and meditating, and I said, not the thoughts, not the memories, not the perceptions, not the imaginations, that means not the nama. All of those things is the nama. The knowing, the vijnana, is the knowing of all of those things. Okay? Rupa, four elements, right? And so these things all together, so this is a complex of consciousness with name and form, is what we call us. That's what we all are. Okay, so name and form, and this are conditions for the six sense fields, right? The sentient organism of the body requires senses to feed its stimuli. Senses are conditioned by conditions for contact. So because you've got senses, you can then encounter the world, and then you get input, like your relation. You have a two-way relationship with the world. Contact is a condition for feeling, because some things that you encounter you like and some you don't. Feeling is a condition for craving, wanting to have pleasure and get away from pain. Craving is a condition for grasping at pleasures, view, observances, and theories of self. Briefly, the difference between craving and grasping is that craving is more of a primal desire, your kind of primal underlying fears, desires, and so on. This is your tanha. Upadana is a more kind of elevated desire. Is you have your theories about it, your ideas about it, yeah? And so it's kind of solidified into a grasping. And that's why the primary agents of dependent origination are mature adults, not animals, not children, all these things. Why? Because they have craving, but they don't really have grasping. I mean, it's still there. I'm not saying it's absent, but the really kind of... Kids will want something, but they don't have a theory about wanting it. It comes and goes. It's like, you know, like if you have a dog, your dog will be angry one moment and the next minute it's let go of it. They don't like hold grudges for years. humans, you keep going over it, right? You have that bad feeling, and then you keep thinking on it, thinking on it, thinking, and you get this idea, this view in your mind. And maybe years later, again, you see that same person, and that same feeling will come up because of the view you have in your mind. This is upadana. Yeah? We talked about that a little bit in the Madhupindika Sutta, about how Dandapani, the Sakya, had been holding on to his view for such a long time. Sorry? Because elephants are close, right? Yeah, so very, very highly intelligent animals like elephants, and look, presumably, you know, dolphins and chimps and, you know, maybe dogs and things like that to some degree.
Magpies. But
magpies? They keep... Magpies, they keep... So they do have these things. So again, I'm not saying it's like 100% that they don't have these things, but not to the same degree as humans do, right? So they might hold a resentment against someone, yes, but they're not going to build an army and to go into war to wipe those people out. I mean, there are kind of limits.
Female matriarchs in elephants deliberately attack cattle as a form of retaliation. They do kill cattle if the members of the herd have been killed by.
So if there's previous.
They'll remember.
They
do that on purpose.
And then they'll plan for it, yeah? Mm. So then that's the upadana. Right, and that, which is of course the flip side, right? You have that upadana, and then it has the positive and negative side. So again, that capacity to do that is not a bad thing in itself, but it's about how you use it. Okay, then bhava, continued existence. I mean, bhava we translated as existence, but in a way you could almost translate it as time. Yeah, bhava is time, bhava is continuity, bhava is this whole thing that we keep on going. Yeah, and it encompasses all of these things. Like in a way, you can include all of these things within bhava. Like if you've seen, like of course, the Tibetan representation of dependent origination, they call the bhava chakra. And so all of the 12 links actually within bhava. And then bhava is conditioned for rebirth. Right? You leave this body behind, get a new one, trade it in. Which might sound good, you know, but on the other hand, it's a bit like kind of ordering something from Amazon. Like you're never quite sure what's going to show up. When it gets born, then you have broken teeth, wrinkled skin, crooked back, and ultimately the failure of the body that we call death. So these are like specific. When the Buddha describes this old age and death, he describes it in very specific and very material terms, like the breaking of the teeth and so on. And I'll be honest. Even as I'm giving this talk tonight, I'm kind of nervous giving the talk tonight because one of my teeth is about to fall out, and I'm starting it. I'm like hoping that I'm going to make it to the end of the talk. Which reminds me, by the way, if anyone's bringing Pindabata on Monday, I'm not going to be there on Monday, yeah, because I'll be at the dentist getting my... So, anyway, it happened to me when I was in India once. I was having this chanting ceremony and having the lunch dana, and Venerable Sivali and Venerable... Kirupakot and Yanananda invited me to come and have lunch with them. So we were sitting there having lunch, and my teeth, same tooth, it's a false tooth I have at the front, and it just kind of went crunch and fell out. Yes. And I'm like, oh, here I am in the middle of India, in Bodh Gaya, with my front teeth all fallen out. And Venerable Yanananda just nods and says, oh, yes, the body is impermanent, isn't it? yes, you're right, Bhante, it is, yeah. So that was my denture had broken, had plastic denture. So anyway, I ended up going to some guy on the side of the road who had like a Bunsen burner and some glue. Stuck it back in. Oh, it worked fine. So anyway, breaking of teeth. I have a long history with that. Okay, so then now, interesting little detail now. The Buddha then goes on. Rebirth is a condition for old age and death. That's what I said. Is that how you see this or not? That's how we see it. Conditioned existence is a condition for rebirth. That's what I said. Is that how you see this or not? So you see that the Buddha is now grilling his students, kind of like what I'm doing, right? So I'm actually trying to adopt these kind of practices of the Buddha to try to make sure that you actually remember these things, because otherwise, even if it's the Buddha, you'd be sitting there and nodding off and falling asleep, thinking, oh God, not dependent origination again. Okay. Then the Buddha says, when this exists, that is, due to the arising of this, that arises. So this is the abstract principle of dependent origination, often called the idapachayata, or specific conditionality. So again, dependent origination is not about everything is interconnected, or everything is related, or everything has a cause. It's about this is the cause for that. So it's about understanding the specific nature of how things condition each other. As the Buddha said, of course, ignorance is a condition for choices. Choice is a condition for consciousness. Consciousness is a condition for name and form. Name and form a condition for six sense fields. Six sense fields a condition for
contact.
Contact a condition for feeling. Feeling a condition for craving. Craving a condition for grasping. Grasping a condition for continued existence. Continued existence a condition for rebirth, for old age and death. And that's how this entire mass of suffering originates. But when ignorance fades away and ceases with nothing left over, what ceases?
Consciousness.
Choices. When choices cease,
consciousness
ceases. When consciousness ceases, nama rupa, name and form cease. When name and form cease, six sense fields cease. When six sense fields cease, contact ceases. When contact ceases, feeling. When feeling ceases, craving. When craving ceases, grasping. When grasping ceases, continued existence. When continued existence ceases, rebirth ceases. When rebirth ceases, old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, sickness, and distress and despair cease. And that is how this entire mass of suffering ceases. Yes. So the Buddha goes and goes through another round of interrogating the monks, which I will skip over. So, but it works, right? It's a good method. Yeah? See, now you all know. I was inspired, one of my inspirations for this was Aya Sudama. And for some reason, I can't remember why, when she was at Santi, and a bunch of kids that came, and I can't remember, maybe we'd been talking about it or something like that, and then she said, I can teach these kids dependent origination in 20 minutes. And I'm like, no, you can't. She said, you just watch me. And so she did, and they all came away and they all knew it. I thought, oh, that's pretty good. Okay. So knowing and seeing in this way, would you turn back to the past thinking, did we exist in the past? Did we not exist in the past? What were we in the past? How were we in the past? After being what did we become in the past? No, sir. So this, of course, is all thinking in terms of a self. Knowing and seeing, would you think this? Will we exist in the future? Will we not exist in the future? What will we be in the future? How will we be in the future? After being what will we become in the future? Knowing and seeing in this way is, would you be undecided about the present, thinking, am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? This sentient being, where did it come from? And where will it go? No, sir. Knowing and seeing in this way, would you say? So all of these questions are based on the idea and the assumption of a self. And since these mendicants have seen dependent origination, they know what is the condition for all of these things, and they know where they've come from, and they know where they're going. They're not asking these questions, and they know that these are ultimately fruitless questions, because it's just conditions. Everything that we're experiencing has arisen from conditions, and everything that ceases will cease due to conditions. So knowing and seeing this way, would you say, So the Buddha's going and asking another bunch of trick questions here. Our teacher is respected. We speak like this out of respect for our teacher. Would you say that?
No.
No? You mean you don't respect your teacher? If it makes me... I'm trying not to take it personally. But... All right? No, you wouldn't say you speak like this because of respect for your teacher. You speak like that because you've seen it for yourself. Knowing and seeing this, would you say, our ascetic says this, the samana, we speak like this because it is what he says? No, you wouldn't say that. Would you, knowing and seeing this, would you dedicate yourself to another teacher? No, sir. Knowing in this way, would you believe in that the observances and boisterous, superstitious rites of the various ascetics and Brahmins are the most important things? No, sir. So this is a kind of interesting little kind of phrase. So it's talking about performance of rituals and so on. But notice that the Buddha always has this kind of quite a subtle relationship to rituals. Like he's not saying you can't do these things, right? He's saying you can't fall back on them as the most important things, the sarato, as the essence or the essential thing. Right? So people obviously were doing these kinds of rituals. Obviously the Buddha was not big on encouraging the monks and nuns to be doing these kinds of rituals, right? But you see it these days, you know, people, we do kind of some water sprinkling or tie a string around and so on and so forth. And so a little bit of those kinds of things, it's fine, right? But we don't think, oh, this is the most important thing. Just linguistically, the interesting word there I've translated as boisterous is kutohala. So kotuhala, which literally translates as whence the hubbub. Kutohala. The hala is hubbub. This is not dohala, it's a different word. Yeah, this is kuto, where? Hala, hubbub. I just thought that was fun. Anyway, whence the hubbub? So, curiously enough, this particular word appears once in the Artha Shastra. So the Artha Shastra is this incredible document of political and social life in India from about 100 or 200 years after the Buddha. Period of composition is a bit kind of contested, but really kind of interesting because it gives you all the details of things like spycraft and weights and measures, and how kings are supposed to resolve disputes, and all of this kind of stuff, which is a really kind of a lot of fascinating and detailed information. For example, in this particular case, it uses the same word, hubbub, is used for a spell that a spy would use, right? For when you need to infiltrate a village or a fort, that you put to sleep the guards and the guard dogs. So it actually gives you a spell for putting them all to sleep. Yeah, a bit like, what was it in that, I think it was in the second Harry Potter book when they had to get into the thing with the Cerberus and the three-headed dog, they had to get into the thing and they had to put him to sleep? Yeah, basically one of them. And so this is the kutohala. Right. Okay, fine. So... and the Buddha completes this round of questioning by saying, aren't you speaking only of what you have known and seen and realized for yourselves? Yes, sir. Good, mendicants. You've been guided by me with this teaching that's apparent in the present life, immediately effective, inviting inspection and relevant so that sensible people can know it for themselves. And this, of course, is the chant of the recollection of the Dhamma. Svakkhato bhagavato dhammo, bhagavata dhammo. For when I said that the teaching is apparent in the present life, immediately effective, inviting inspection, relevant so that sensible people can know it for themselves, this is what I was referring to. Okay, so look, we've got towards the kind of the ending of the session, and the most interesting bits in the suttas are the next bits, so we're just going to have to miss those. So I'm not sure. Maybe we could even continue next week. What do you reckon? Maybe we could continue. I wasn't planning to, but it would be kind of a shame to rush through it, and also a shame to miss it because there really are There's really quite a lot of interesting things left there. So maybe we might pick the rest of the Mahatanha Sankhaya Sutta up next week. And I will be interrogating you on dependent origination again. So I will be hoping that you haven't forgotten all of it. Okay? Very good. So this is the Mahatanha Sankhaya Sutta. Okay, very good. Majjhima 38. MN 38. Okay. Okay, so Gillian just asked a nice, simple, easy question. Can I please sort out my use of the following, please? Consciousness, stream of consciousness, vijnana, citta, and awareness. Thanks, Gillian. That's like a really sort of... that's just a really kind of minor little footnote here to add to it. Look, basically pretty much the same kind of thing. I was using all of those in pretty much the same way. Citta is typically used in the context of meditation. Vijnana usually in the context of wisdom, right? So vijnana typically belongs to the first noble truth, and citta belongs to the fourth noble truth. But they basically have a similar kind of meaning in what I was saying. Stream of consciousness, of course, is specifically used in the sense of the consciousness which is established in one life and the next. So Dhiriyupa asked me to explain further about the origin of source of choices being ignorance. So basically just think about it this way, that you don't know what the hell you're doing, so you just do something. And you do something because you think it might work. And you think maybe this time it'll make me happy. And you keep on doing it again and again and again. And it kind of works a bit, right? So that's Mara's role, right? So Mara's role is then to step in and convince you that, oh yeah, it does make you happy, you know, and to just kind of just, you know, it usually doesn't take us much, you know? It usually doesn't take us much to be convinced to take the next step. If we just get, you know, and this of course is the design of social media, right? So they basically figured that even if you get like a tiny minimal hit of dopamine from a post or from something like that, that's enough to keep you going. Like you don't actually have to feel happy or anything like that, but you just have to get this almost like this tiny drip of pleasure, and that's enough so that you're going to keep on going to the next one and the next one and the next one until like hours have gone past and you realize, what is my life about? Yeah. So this is the ignorance and choices. Yeah, Nilushi, yeah.
I just wanted to ask a bit more about grasping again.
Yeah.
Sounding like you're talking about analytical thinking almost, like you're saying that it's a view based on your reaction to feelings.
Yeah.
But I mean, can't we sort of have an intelligent opinion on something? Like how is that every single
Yeah. Well, a view is like a sort of a relatively stable structure in your mind, right? So it's not like a thought or something like that. And the view also is different from analytical thinking, right? Analytical thinking is a process. Now, you might have a view about that process, which is a different thing, right? So, but a view is something which is relatively stable. Like in Thai, they use the word view for where in English we would use the word theory, and so the theory of evolution is Trithvi Hangan Vi Wat, and so it's basically it's a somewhat fixed structure in the mind, which will frame the way that you receive things. And the way that you put them out again.
But aren't we all completely like that? We all have views that inherently shape our perceptions.
Absolutely, yeah.
And how do we... So then all that...
That's right, yeah. So we have views are a part, an essential part of how your mind works. Right? So it's not that views itself are inherently bad, but again, attachment to the views. Yeah. Again, I mean, this is something, for example, consider, say, the context of science, right? So in science, we theoretically have the idea that it's subject to evidence. Everybody knows this, right? So if you have some evidence that contradicts the scientific theory, then that calls the theory into question. At the same time, theories should have a bit of stickiness, because it often happens that somebody will come up with some evidence, but then it later turns out maybe there was something wrong with the experiment or the interpretation or something like that. So you're not going to necessarily throw away the theory just because you get one result. But you should still be open to that. It can still be the case. I mean, the classic example is if you say all swans are white. Well, you just have to visit Perth and go to the Swan River, and immediately that theory is out the drain. Yeah? So, but of course, even in somewhere like science, it's not quite necessarily like that. You know, what do they say, that science proceeds according to the pace of the death of the professors? So even people, you see Mike's having a good chuckle about that, even in science, you know, a classic example in modern science was Einstein versus the quantum theorists, Niels Bohr and so on, when Einstein had this incredible insight into relativity, and then he was never really able to reconcile that with quantum mechanics, even though the findings of quantum mechanics, the evidence was very clear, but actually how you understand it and how you make sense of it, the view you have about it, even for someone like Einstein, who, I mean, the clarity of whose thought and insight when he created his theories of relativity was astonishing. But even for him, to be able to let go of that and to revise that in that way was a difficult thing. Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult thing for everyone, but even for him. So this is why, you know, there needs to be a sort of a certain degree of, you know, flexibility with these things. And even, say, with the Buddha's teachings, right? So with the Buddha's teachings, you know, for most of the people here, you know, we have a certain degree of belief in that. Now, maybe there might be degrees of commitment or something like that. But in any case, we kind of believe in the Buddha's teaching. Now, maybe there are some things that we see that maybe don't agree or conflict with the Buddha's teachings. You might see, for example, that, like a scientific idea that consciousness is dependent on brain activity, right? And that appears to conflict with what the Buddha thought. And, you know, maybe it's the case that actually disproves this whole idea of consciousness and rebirth that the Buddha was teaching, right? But it's also true that science doesn't actually really have a very good handle on what consciousness is and how it relates to the brain, and that this is a deeply philosophical and deeply ideological question. So it's the kind of thing that, you know, it's definitely, you know, you want to keep an open mind about it, but you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. So this is what I like to try to have, that kind of relationship with views that has, you know, there needs to be a certain degree of holdingness to the view, but to hold them gently, you know, but holding gently can also be holding firmly, but not you're not just abandoning your views on a whim, but you're also not insisting and holding on them to them too rigidly. Yeah. 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 You certainly can. Please, ask away.
So with metta meditation, how I remember you teaching it was once you get that feeling of metta in your mind,
yeah,
you figure out where in your body it's right, and try to grow that feeling until it spills over into the rest of the body. Is that right?
Not quite. No. It's not that you try to figure out where in your body it is, but normally when the question was about when metta, just for those folks online, but the question was about when feeling of metta arises in your body in metta meditation. It typically arises in a location in your body.
Sure.
Yeah. Look, again, it's perception. So it's not going to be the same for everyone, but often that's what happens. So you're not like trying to figure that out. It just happens to be there, yeah. But then, yes, you grow it until it's strong, and then gradually you let it spill out to the rest of your body.
So, like, two things with that. What if it arises in multiple places at the same time. So like face, hands, you just choose one.
If it arises in multiple places, good. I've got metta in too many places in my body. Like, it's fine. The purpose of it is to be able to focus on and stabilize the feeling. Yeah. So just try and see what's going to work best for you to be able to do that. But typically, yeah, to focus on the place that it's going to be the strongest. Yeah.
And if it's jumping around?
If it's jumping around, then that's the relationship between the mind and the nama rupa and vijnana, right? If it's feelings jumping around, it's because there's hindrances or restlessness in your mind. So don't jump around after it. That's just like trying to keep up with the monkey who's leaping around the forest. Yeah, so just try it again. Just try to get your best sense of where it feels best for that metta, and then keep your focus and your attention there. And then let the feeling come quietly to you. Yeah, so don't go chasing it too much. Yeah.
Okay, I know it's almost 9 o'clock, but I'm really curious about this. If I may ask one last question.
Please.
On that note, if I understood it correctly, when one is in meditation, mm-hmm. you don't really create any karma.
Well, you create good karma, right?
But if I remember correctly, you said that. Just like what was said in the Sutta, Mother Sajjana said this, but maybe you didn't. Anyway, I'm not misrepresenting it. But I was pretty sure you mentioned that maybe when one is in samadhi,
yeah.
one is not generating any karma.
I don't think I would have said that. But anyway, go on, ask your question.
Okay, so in that case, then maybe I was wrong. Just
yeah.
Because I thought if that's the case, then, you know, let's say when you're doing metta meditation and there's that feeling.
Yeah.
Aren't you making karma then?
Yeah, sure, you are, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, the thing is, in meditation or something like that, you're not kind of making moral choices in that kind of way, right? But, you might be making bad moral choices. You might be saying, I'm going to do this meditation because I want to put a curse on someone. Right? In which case you've got a bad intention. But normally we do meditation for that good intention. But that good intention is it kind of underlies that whole process of meditation. Right? It's not like you're actually in that meditation and then I'm gonna, you know, make that choice to do this or to do that. And so you're not like creating a karma in that kind of straightforward way. But that whole process is a process of developing a mind that has an intentionality towards freedom and peace and so on. So that whole process has a direction to it. Yeah. Okay. And just a couple of other questions online, which I will address quickly before we go on. Eddie asks, is choices here that sankhara the same as in the fourth khandhas? Yes, it has the same meaning here as in the four khandhas. Why do other people translate it as mental formations? Oh, dear. Look, honestly, the reason why people translate it as mental formations is because previous generations of translators were strongly influenced by the Abhidhamma, and the Abhidhamma explains these things differently, and I think incorrectly. So that's really the reason why that translation of mental formations was originally, I think, Venerable Nyanaponika. To describe sankhara as a mental formation is not necessarily incorrect in and of itself, but it's kind of missing the point a bit about what actually sankhara is doing in the five khandhas, which is making choices. Is bhava equals drive? No. No, the drive would be more like upadana or tanha, right? It's your drive. Bhava more like, yeah, just being life. Life. Rebirth is a Dear Yupa suggested instead of a mass of suffering, we should translate it as a mess of suffering. That is an excellent suggestion, and I'll go home directly after this and do a mass find and replace across the whole planet. maybe. Yeah. Okay, so that's about it for the night. So thanks, everybody. thanks for sticking with me through all this. I know that it can be kind of challenging and stuff, but that's the fun, right? So at least, you know, if you come to Bhante Sujata's talks, at least you know that you're probably going to hear something that you haven't heard before, hopefully. And so, yeah, like I said, next week we're going to be ending the rains retreat, ending the Vasa, but these talks will continue. And I'll also be back at Crow's Nest, not this Wednesday, when Nilushi's brother is doing his final talk. So do, if for those around, then please do go along to the Crow's Nest for that. That's been continuing, but I'll be continuing there after the rains, and I'll be doing that together with Venerable Karunika. And so she's happy, and so there'll be other speakers from time to time, but we'll be probably the main two there. So it's the Crow's Nest Wednesday night at the Crow's Nest Centre, and here Friday night at the Harris Park Centre. We also have our Katina ceremony on